Donald Trump more dangerous, more erratic than ever before.
We're echoing fascists.
The worst people are the enemies from within.
The enemy from within are more dangerous than Russia.
We have some very bad people. It should be very easily handled by the military.
I do remember the day that he suggested that we shoot people on the streets.
A second term would be worse. There will be no one to stop his worst instincts. Unchecked power, no guardrails. If we elect Trump again, we're in terrible danger.
Well, that sounds like fun. Good start.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling there's something right.
Nope, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also elsewhere in California, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Hawaii, Ohio, New York, Louisiana, New Mexico, New Hampshire, Arkansas, Washington State, Wisconsin, and Minnesota on fine terrestrial affiliates, not to mention a whole bunch of streaming websites as well. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com with a whole bunch to get to on today's Bradcast. Thank you very much for joining us for it. Even though I have a sneaking suspicion that the tipping point state for this year's election may end up being Pennsylvania, we'll see. Nonetheless, our nearly trademark coverage at this point of voting and voting issues and voting and tabulation concerns, and I have many of them, in the great state of Georgia shall not be deterred, Desi Doyen.
Well, we have many, many potential tipping points, and it's going to be a nail-biter to the end,
well,
I fear.
Well, I tell you, and especially today, because we've got a whole bunch of what I think are good news stories out today about Georgia elections. We will get to those stories in a little bit. But first, you know, we spent a lot of time yesterday on the Bradcast on Donald Trump's increasingly authoritarian threats based on utter lies regarding not just migrants in the U.S., which he has been ramping up to to chilling proportions of late, but now also threats to American citizens who he perceives as enemies of his, as he recently threatened that if he was elected again, he might use the U.S. military to round up those people as well. I want to get to a bit more on that in a moment, but here's the paradox as I see it. Even when the media, including myself, cover terrible things that Donald Trump is doing, it still, in some sense, seems to help Donald Trump. It's a paradox because we are talking about him, apparently, putting the focus on him and therefore not on Kamala Harris, and somehow that helps Donald Trump. It's one of the reasons that even amid several weeks of horrible press coverage for Trump and his running mate, J.D. Vance, while they were, for example, lying about Haitian migrants eating cats and dogs in Springfield, Ohio, his polling numbers kind of went up. They certainly didn't go down. And even now, while Trump is lying about the federal response to Hurricanes Helene and Milton, which we will have more on in Desi Doyen's Green News Report
later. But what you're talking about, I think, is the idea that any publicity, even bad publicity, is good publicity.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that seems to be one of the codes that Donald Trump has sort of cracked. Kamala Harris's campaign and the successes of the Biden-Harris administration are not getting the coverage because we're talking about Donald Trump and how terrible he is. It would be irresponsible to not cover, you know, Trump threatening, for example, to unleash the National Guard and the U.S. military against American citizens. But paradoxically, in doing so, it actually seems like it somewhat helps Donald Trump, because the focus remains on him. It's just one of the reasons why he is so dangerous. as he's sort of cracked the code of media coverage to that end. And I don't know, frankly, what the solution to it is. I've been trying to figure it out for, I don't know, the last 8 or 9 years, because we still need to cover that stuff. But with that in mind, let me just take a quick minute or two here, at least today, to cover some stuff that might at least serve as some balance for all of that Trump coverage. For example, since Trump still seems to score well on some in some polling regarding who would be better for the economy, Kamala Harris or Donald Trump, here's just a quick roundup of what the economy is actually doing right now as it's firing on all cylinders under the policies of the Biden-Harris administration. Is sort of a quickly summarized here on MSNBC last night by Rachel Maddow in a way that the corporate mainstream media has not really been doing a very good job of doing.
Today, the stock market closed above 43,000 for the first time in history. That's the Dow Jones Industrial Average hitting all-time highs. The S&P 500 hit its all-time high today as well. And this isn't a flash in the pan. We just hit 2 years of this bull market. This year alone, the S&P 500 is up almost 23% in 1 year. Inflation is where it was when Trump left office. Economic growth under the first 3 years of the Biden-Harris administration, we now know, is higher than economic growth was under the first 3 years of the Trump administration. The Trump people don't like you to count the fourth year. They don't like you to count the economic catastrophe we all experienced under Trump in his fourth year in office. They say, you know, that the pandemic in his fourth year, that it means it shouldn't count. You shouldn't count anything that happened under his watch then, which is frankly pretty weak sauce. But even, you know, okay, even if you take him on those weak terms and you cut out the real lived economic catastrophe on his watch during the pandemic, you know, other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play? Even if you cut out his fourth year because of COVID, we now know economic growth under Biden and Harris is better in their first 3 years than it was under Trump in his first 3 years. Economic growth is up. Wages are up. Retail sales are good. Interest rates are dropping. We are having record highs on Wall Street. Biden and Harris, this administration has produced the best job growth numbers of any presidential administration in American history by a mile. Unemployment numbers are profoundly low and in a sustained way. It's the best unemployment figures that we have seen in decades. A few days ago, the New York Times summed it all up sort of begrudgingly. With this, quote, "The economy is robust. By many measures, the U.S. job market is as healthy as it has ever been." As healthy as it has ever been. In the history of the United States of America, we right now have the best job market we have ever had as a country, as long as we have existed as a country. At the Washington Post, economist Heather Long recently put it this way under the headline, quote, "This is a great economy." It says, quote, "Growth is strong, unemployment is low, inflation is back down. Many Americans are getting sizable pay raises. Middle class wealth has surged to record levels. The United States has nearly 7 million more jobs than it did before the pandemic. And we have the largest share of adults age 25 to 54 working in more than two decades, the largest share working in 24 years. Americans in the bottom 40% of income have experienced the fastest of all the wage growth, the largest surge in wealth since the end of 2019 has gone to the bottom 50% in income. Bottom line, quote, 2024 is shaping up to be one of the best economic years of many Americans' lifetimes.
Well, that sounds good. Seems like there should be at least some coverage of that. So I'm glad Rachel Maddow did that. A couple of weeks ago at brandblog.com, Ernie Canning wrote a similar article, not just about the improvement of Biden-Harris and their administration over Donald Trump's on these economic numbers, but also comparing Barack Obama's last 3 years to Donald Trump's first 3 years, you know, since, again, he doesn't like to count that pandemic year. But comparing Obama to Trump, well, prices were up, job growth was down during Trump compared to Barack Obama's last 3 years in office, comparing Trump's first 3 years in office. Despite what he likes to say about it as the best economy of all time, it absolutely wasn't. Now, Maddow on Monday night went on to detail how major economic firms now say that Harris's economic plan will result in far more growth, higher GDP, lower inflation, more job creation, much lower government deficits and national debt than Donald Trump's economic plan. And how there really is no basis for those who claim that Trump's policies, economic policies, are somehow better for business and the economy and Wall Street or even the national debt and deficit. There is no basis to make that claim. Billionaire Mark Cuban, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, he of Shark Tank fame, and one time Donald Trump's supporter, big supporter, joined Maddow on her show to help make that case. For now, I don't have that much to add to it, but given the amount of Trump coverage, it does seem worth noting from time to time today, as voting is now underway in every state, with Election Day less than 3 weeks away. And speaking of Kamala Harris, she too has some thoughts on Donald Trump's threats to unleash the U.S. military against American citizens. Not just immigrants, but citizens, as she discussed during one of her rallies in Erie, Pennsylvania on Monday night.
And so after all these years, we know who Donald Trump is. He is someone who will stop at nothing to claim power for himself. And you don't have to take my word for it. I've said for a while now, watch his rallies. Listen to his words. He tells us who he is, and he tells us what he would do if he is elected president. So here tonight, I will show you one example of Donald Trump's worldview and intentions. Please roll the clip.
The worst people are the enemies from within.
The enemy from within. Those people are more dangerous, the enemy from within, than Russia and China.
These people should be put in jail the way they talk about our judges and our justices.
Now, if you had one really violent day, one rough hour, and I mean real rough.
I think the bigger problem are the people from within. We have some very bad people. We have some sick people, radical left lunatics. And I think they're the big, and it should be very easily handled by, if necessary, by National Guard, or if really necessary, by the military.
You heard his words coming from him. He's talking about the enemy within Pennsylvania. He's talking about the enemy within our country, Pennsylvania. He's talking about that he considers anyone who doesn't support him or who will not bend to his will an enemy of our country. It's a serious issue. He is saying that he would use the military to go after them. Think about this. And we know who he would target. And we know who he would target because he has attacked them before. Journalists whose stories he doesn't like. Election officials who refuse to cheat by filling extra votes and finding extra votes for him. Judges who insist on following the law instead of bending to his will. This is among the reasons I believe so strongly that a second Trump term would be a huge risk for America and dangerous. Donald Trump is increasingly unstable and unhinged.
Yeah, he is. It was Kamala Harris in Erie, Pennsylvania on Monday night. So perhaps allowing her to make that case instead of us, at least for a moment, may not help Donald Trump quite as much, under the theory that I think many Americans, it seems, sort of end up voting for the last person that they've heard about.
God, I hope not.
In the media. Well, that's kind of what it seems. And speaking of unstable and unhinged, the parade of former Trump officials and friends of his, like Mark Cuban, who are now sticking their neck out to support Kamala Harris over Trump and to warn about Trump, well, that parade continues today. Remember when Stephanie Grisham, who worked in various roles in the Trump White House, including his communications director and his press secretary. Remember when she came out at the Democratic National Convention over the summer to endorse Kamala Harris?
Behind closed doors, Trump mocks his supporters. He calls them basement dwellers. On a hospital visit one time when people were dying in the ICU, he was mad that the cameras were not watching him. He has no empathy, no morals, and no fidelity to the truth. He used to tell me, "It doesn't matter what you say, Stephanie. Say it enough and people will believe you." But it does matter. What you says matter, and what you don't say matters. When I was press secretary, I got skewered for never holding a White House briefing. It's because, unlike my boss, I never wanted to stand at that podium and lie. Now here I am, behind a podium, advocating for a Democrat. And that's because I love my country more than my party. Kamala Harris tells the truth, she respects the American people, and she has my vote.
That was Donald Trump's press secretary, Stephanie Grisham, at the Democratic National Convention endorsing Kamala Harris. And she's hardly the only top aide in Trump's White House to come out strongly for Kamala Harris. So have former Trump White House Director of Strategic Communications and the Assistant to the President in 2020, Alyssa Farah Griffin, and, of course, the top aide to Trump's last chief of staff, Cassidy Hutchinson. They have all come out to endorse Kamala Harris over their old boss. And on Monday night, as The Hill reported, Sarah Matthews, another former spokesperson for Donald Trump in the White House, said that she, too, is backing Vice President Harris to ensure that the former president, quote, never steps foot in the Oval Office again. In an interview on Monday, Matthews said simply speaking out against her former boss was not enough. She added that it was important for her to, quote, take that next step and show that it's okay to put partisanship aside and prioritize your country. And so that's why, she said, I was willing to endorse Kamala Harris because I believe that we need to do everything we can to ensure that Donald Trump never steps foot in the Oval Office again. Like former Republican House leadership member and former Trump ally Liz Cheney, Sarah Matthews has expressed that she believes Trump is a threat to democracy, saying that the January 6th Capitol riots, quote, showed that, and that was part of my reason for resigning, she said. When pressed on whether she's faced threats or harassment since leaving the Trump administration, Matthews confirmed, in fact, she had. But she said she calculated the risk and determined it was worth it to speak out against the GOP nominee. Quote, I know that there's harassment and backlash in terms of my career prospects, and I probably won't be able to have a career in Republican politics, at least in the current makeup of the Republican Party, she said on Monday. But for me, what scared me more was the idea of a second Trump term. If I sat on the sidelines of history and didn't say anything and speak out and know that I could have used my voice to help dissuade people from voting for him again. And so that, for me, she said, it was an easy calculation. That was Trump's former deputy press secretary who resigned after Trump's January 6 attack on the U.S. Capitol. And one more today before we take a break and come back with several items of, I think, good news out of Georgia. Geraldo Rivera. I know, who cares about Geraldo Rivera? But I bet you Trump, Donald Trump, cares about Geraldo Rivera. Veteran newsman Geraldo Rivera has finally broken away from his old friend Donald Trump and is endorsing Kamala Harris for president. Rivera made the announcement on Monday in a detailed post on Twitter that began with the words, quote, sore loser. In the post, Rivera said when Trump was in office, quote, he was a loyal friend who allowed regular access, and he admits that he gave Trump, quote, the benefit of most doubts. Geraldo said he stuck with Trump throughout the various scandals in office, including the Mueller investigation into allegations that Trump conspired with Russia. Quote, I stuck with him, deeply suspicious of constant efforts to undermine his administration, Rivera said, adding that he hasn't spoken with his old pal since November 13 of 2020. Quote, it was 10 days after his narrow loss to Joe Biden. He was calling to get my take on the controversy surrounding the election. I asked him what he would do if the vote count remained against him. As I reported on Fox News that same morning, he told me he was a reasonable man and would do the right thing if that time ever came. It never did, says Geraldo. Instead, President Trump embarked on an increasingly menacing campaign to discredit the 2020 election. With a motley supporting cast of increasingly fringe characters, he careened from one bizarre theory to the next, offering no meaningful proof that he had been robbed by the Democrats. None exists, he added. If you are a Republican, Donald Trump has made a liar of you, Rivera wrote last night. He has coaxed and intimidated tens of millions into pretending he was reelected in 2020 and that the election was stolen. Geraldo also went on to accuse Trump of, quote, stabbing the Constitution in the back on January 6 by inciting and unleashing the violent attack on the center of democracy, the U.S. Capitol. However you justify voting for Trump, adopting his big lie about the stolen election makes you a liar. He's right. The post then ends with Rivera declaring Trump, quote, a sore loser who cannot be trusted to honor the Constitution before announcing, quote, that is why I am voting for Kamala Harris to be our 47th president. Well done, Geraldo. What took you so long, I guess I should add.
Yeah, and I wonder if it will push anyone to say, gosh, maybe I should rethink my support of this guy that almost everyone who worked for him and know him personally say that this guy Trump is a grave threat to democracy. You'd think that that would matter more to more people.
You would think. Maybe it does. Maybe it will. We'll see. If they know about it, of course, which is one of the reasons I wanted to share those couple of items. And of course, given that there are now hundreds of former Republican officials from the Trump administration and other former Republican administrations, along with Donald Trump's friends who know him best, people like Mark Cuban and Geraldo Rivera, who are now backing and openly endorsing Kamala Harris. Well, I'd love to be fair and balanced here, to quote what Fox News used to pretend to be, to share the long list of top former Democratic administration officials who are now endorsing Donald Trump. But there are, let me check my paperwork here, none of them, apparently. Zero. I wonder why. Quick break, and we are back to some late-breaking election news out of Georgia today. And later, Desiree's latest Green News Report,
which
is always lots of fun, lots of laughs. All of that is ahead today on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At The Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
We're always going back to Georgia. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. I mentioned Desi Doyen coming up in a little bit with some of the fallout from the hurricanes, both Helene and Milton.
Yeah, we're still dealing with all of that.
Still dealing with the aftermath there. But when it comes to Georgia, at least when it comes to elections, well, I think we've got some good news today. Election officials in Georgia say absentee ballots went out by the U.S. Postal Service as scheduled and were not impacted by the hurricanes, as the first day of early voting is now underway as of today in the critical battleground state. Quote, so far we have seen just over 250,000 voters request absentee ballots. Perhaps in the next week or so, we'll see that rise up to 300,000. And that, we think, will probably look like around 5 to 6% of all voters will be voting absentee this cycle, says Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger. That number, of course, 5 to 6%, should, in my opinion, be much higher, given the fact that without voting via a hand-marked absentee ballot, voters in Georgia will still be required at the polling place to vote on 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting systems this year, which have been shown during a recent federal court trial, for example, challenging the use of those machines to be very easily hacked with little more than a ballpoint pen in Georgia. They have also been exposed to other vulnerabilities following the unlawful breach and distribution of the system's proprietary hardware and software by Trump allies in Coffee County, Georgia, the day after the January 6, 2021 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. To date, despite the threat that that breach posed to those systems that everyone must use at the polling place, and the fact that Donald Trump and four others have been indicted on felony charges related to that breach, despite all of that, Raffensperger, the Secretary of State there, has refused to apply security update patches that were made by the voting system manufacturer until after the 2024 election. Very helpful, Raff. All told, that means a vote cast on a hand-marked absentee paper ballot and dropped off at a county drop box is a much, much more secure way, at least in Georgia, to maximize the odds of your ballot being counted as cast. But of course, the Georgia Secretary of State's office also makes applying for absentee ballots in the state far more difficult than it needs to be, with one Georgia voter who was recently denied in his first attempt at applying for an absentee ballot because he forgot to put his birth date onto the application, even though he did include his state voter ID number. He sent me a copy of Georgia's absentee ballot application, and it is wildly complicated and difficult to both follow and fill out correctly. So I'm not surprised that he made that mistake. I mean, it's like filling out a tax form,
but with really tiny print.
They really do not want you to vote absentee in Georgia. So if you plan on doing that in Georgia, which I do recommend, well, I would say, you know, get started yesterday on that process to be able to go through everything in time. If for whatever reason you cannot vote via absentee, however, in Georgia, do not let our coverage about our concerns about the polling place touchscreen systems deter you from voting. Vote on them anyway if that is your only option. With the first day of early voting in Georgia now underway, the chief operating officer for the Secretary of State's office, Gabe Sterling, said that he expects the Peach State to set a new record for voter turnout. Earlier on Tuesday, Sterling told CNN, quote, "We're at 90,000 people today who have already voted early, and the record for first day early voting in Georgia was in 2020, and that was 136,000. He said it is not even lunchtime yet, adding that we're going to blow away that 2020 number, blow it out of the water, he said. Whether that is good or bad news for either of the presidential candidates, however, or anybody else who's on the ballot, that is largely unknown at the moment. But good turnout is, I would suggest, always a good thing.
Yeah, good news for voters. You know, they have to overcome all of the obstacles placed in their way, and they are doing it.
In Georgia, bring your own food, bring your own water. You're not allowed to give any food or water to anybody in line. As we've been reporting in recent weeks, a spate of last-minute rules changes in Georgia by the newly seated MAGA majority on the state elections board has resulted in a whole lot of panic by a lot of folks that these new rules, such as allowing county elections boards to carry out a, quote, reasonable inquiry into any concerns about fraud or tabulation error, or to seek public documents regarding the election, or to require that election workers hand count the number of ballots cast at the end of the night, not the results on the ballot, but just the number of ballots before transporting the computer-marked ballots from the state's touchscreen voting systems to the county headquarters. Panic by many that those new rules would be used as a predicate for MAGA election officials in the counties to not certify election results, and thus put the results of this key battleground state into doubt and possibly even prevent their electoral college votes from being included in the final results in determining the winner of the presidential election nationwide. So concerns at both the state and federal level. As we've also reported in covering those concerns, there is actually nothing that the state election board can do to hold up the mandatory certification date for those results in each county as specified by state law. It must occur by 5 p.m. on Monday following the Tuesday election date in Georgia. In other words, while I understand that people are very worried that some MAGA election officials will try to hold up certification of results, the state election code says they may not do so for any reason. I know that a lot of Democrats were very concerned, and I kept pointing, well, look at the actual state election code. The state election board cannot change the state law, and the state law says, yeah, it must be certified by the following Monday. If there are concerns about the county results, those results must be certified nonetheless, and any challenges that are to take place must happen after the certification in court, etc., if questions remain about the accuracy of those certified results. Well, a state judge in Atlanta on Tuesday confirmed what we have been reporting to that end. As the Atlanta Journal-Constitution reports today, certifying elections is a required duty of county election boards in Georgia, and they are not allowed to refuse finalizing results based on suspicions of miscounts or fraud. That, according to a Fulton County judge's ruling on Tuesday. Feel better about things, Desi Doyen?
A little bit.
Superior Court Judge Robert McBurney rejected claims that were brought by a Fulton County Election Board member named Julie Adams, who had voted against certifying this spring's presidential primary in a bit of a trial run, I guess. Now, if Judge McBurney's name sounds familiar to you, it's likely because he was the one who oversaw, some years ago now, the special grand jury process that was brought by Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis that eventually resulted in the criminal conspiracy charges against Donald Trump and 15 or so others. related to their attempt to steal the 2020 election in Georgia that Trump lost there to Joe Biden. So McBurney ruled that Georgia law requires certification. It's not optional. County boards do not have discretion to not do so. Reading from today's ruling, the court declares the following. One, an election superintendent's role in certifying election results pursuant to state law is ministerial, even though many other aspects of her position are discretionary. Two, regardless of the characterization of the election superintendent's role in certifying results, that certification pursuant to state law is mandatory. He is spelling this out. Three, consequently, no election superintendent or member of a board of elections may refuse to certify or abstain from certifying election results under any circumstances, the judge writes. Adding in a footnote, this does not leave the superintendent or board member without recourse or the means to voice substantive concerns about an election outcome. The election code has a tested mechanism for addressing alleged fraud and abuse. That would be election contests. And he cites the relevant statutes in state law. Election contests arise after the ministerial act of certification. He says they may be brought by a losing candidate or by an aggrieved elector, a voter, which includes a superintendent assuming that she voted. Importantly, election contests occur in open court under the watchful eye of a judge and the public. The claims of fraud from one side are tested by the opposing side in that open court, rather than being silently adjudicated by a superintendent outside the public space, resulting in votes being excluded from the final count without due process being afforded those voters. So does that make sense? A board of election member can't just, you know, investigate fraud and make a determination that these votes shouldn't be counted without anybody being able to oversee the process, as would be the case in a court case. That's why these things are brought in court. They're not determined by these boards of elections. I think this is actually a valuable point to remember in other states as well moving forward. That's why challenges take place in court, not before election officials secretly. Four, the judge continues, if in performing her responsibility set forth in state law, quote, to inspect systematically and thoroughly the conduct of primaries and elections in the several precincts of his or her county, to the end that primaries and elections may be honestly, efficiently, and uniformly conducted, an election superintendent or member of a board of elections determines a need for election information from the staff of the superintendent's office or from the board, that information, if not protected from disclosure by law, regulation, or rule, should be promptly provided. In other words, if a member of the Board of Elections has some question, wants to see the voting roll, wants to see who voted at a particular polling place, they ought to be allowed to see that. However, the judge adds, any delay in receiving such information is not a basis for refusing to certify the election results or to abstain from doing so. Judge McBurney's order concludes thusly, quote, if election superintendents were, as plaintiff urges, free to play investigator, prosecutor, jury, and judge, and so, because of a unilateral determination of error or fraud, refuse to certify election results, Georgia voters would be silenced. Our Constitution and our election code do not allow for that to happen. So that seems to me to be a pretty damn clear finding about the responsibility of these boards of elections in Georgia. The ruling comes as the judge hears a challenge on Tuesday to other new rules that were passed by the state election board, including a requirement for a election night hand count of the number of ballots cast. So those new rules, which the experts on Georgia law who I've spoken with do not find nearly as troubling as many of the Democrats who seem to be freaking out about them, those new rules will be tested in court as well as to whether they come too late in the election process. I think a good case can be made for that. But the key concern that many had about those new rules was that they could be used somehow to hold up certification of the results in the state. And those concerns would seem to be unfounded, at least if Judge McBurney's ruling here today is upheld through any appeals, et cetera.
Yeah, that was my very next question was, well, is it possible that the Georgia State Supreme Court can say, nah, overturning McBurney?
Well, yeah, a higher court can overturn anything.
So they can still intervene.
If they can still intervene if they found that he was in error here. But he spelled out his ruling. We'll see if the higher court, I guess it would be the Georgia Supreme Court at this point, has a differing opinion. But for now, the Georgia State Court was pretty damn clear about this. Julie Adams, the plaintiff in the case, and a Republican appointee to the Fulton County Elections Board had sued after she had declined to certify the presidential and general primary earlier this year because other county officials declined to fulfill her request for a long list of election documents before the certification deadline. So the judge says, yeah, you can ask for these documents. They should be provided promptly. But if they are not, it does not give you the cause to hold up the certification of results. Adams had claimed in her suit that she was, quote, unable to fulfill her oath of office without those documents. She was outvoted by the Democratic majority on the Fulton Election Board, which did certify the primaries anyway, which is another point that I've been trying to highlight here. The majority on Georgia State County Election Boards of Elections generally reflect the political leanings of that particular county in question. So if a majority of county board members were attempting to hold up certification of results because the majority was MAGA, for example, and they were trying to cause problems, well, they would most likely be hurting the final vote count for the Republican candidate by holding up the vote count in their own counties because they're probably going to be majority Republican counties. And the Democratic-leaning counties, for example, Fulton County, where this case takes place, that includes part of Atlanta, that would have a majority Democratic board. And, you know, the Democratic majority board in this case voted to certify the results, to not withhold those strongly Democratic-leaning votes. So, you know, if there were MAGA folks in some of these Republican counties trying to block certification, they would be holding up votes for Donald Trump. Nonetheless, McBurney's ruling would seem to clear up any questions about whether any member of any county board of election has a right to hold up the certification, at least at the county level. So far, so good from the Georgia State Court on these concerns. As I noted, McBurney will have other rulings on some of these other rules that have been put in place by the State Board of Elections at the last minute.
Yeah, but I think it's really important that we should all just still stay vigilant in Georgia and Pennsylvania.
I ain't saying don't stay vigilant.
I know you aren't, and all states, because I think that the MAGA folks have proven that they will keep trying no matter what they have to do, up stuff even to overturn the results should Trump lose.
They will complain about this ruling from McBurney.
Yeah, and there are many that are now in positions of power in elections to throw some wrenches in there.
They will complain about this ruling, even if they have to certify, they'll, you know, once we get to January 6th, they'll say, well, we didn't want to certify, but we had to, and Congress will try to use that to try to hold up results. All of this, of course, only if Trump does not win. If he wins, everything will be fine. Don't worry. But that's what they are absolutely planning to do. But as far as, you know, we have a limited amount of anger and concern. And so let's, use it where it is most helpful here. And speaking of both good news out of Georgia and Trump's failed attempt to steal the last election there back in 2020 and long overdue consequences for those who tried to help him, one of the main right-wing websites that spread the false claims of election fraud in 2020 against two former Fulton County election workers has now settled a defamation lawsuit that was filed by those two women. The settlement was filed in a St. Louis, Missouri circuit court last week, where Ruby Freeman and Shay Moss had sued The Gateway Pundit, an influential right-wing site, and its dopey owner, Jim Hoft, and his dopey brother, Joe Hoft, who all shared false and misleading, and in this case, defamatory information about the 2020 election. The filing in St. Louis City Circuit Court didn't give any terms of the settlement that was struck, but said actions under the agreement are supposed to be complete by March 29. So both sides have now asked the judge to postpone the case until then, when they expect to request a dismissal. The attorneys for Freeman, Moss, and the Gateway Pundit stated in a joint notice of settlement that they were asking the telling the court that they have reached an agreement and to hold off for things. In a statement by the legal team for Freeman and Moss, they said the dispute, quote, has been resolved to the mutual satisfaction of the parties through a fair and reasonable settlement, which sounds to me like the dumb but duplicitous Hoft brothers agreed to pay a whole lot of money to make this case against them go away. Jim Hoft's company that owns the Gateway Pundit had filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy reorganization some months ago, but a judge dismissed that case in July, finding that the company was totally solvent and had filed that suit in bad faith in an effort to frustrate the lawsuit by Freeman and Moss. You'll recall that Freeman and Moss tallied ballots at Atlanta's State Farm Arena on election night in 2020. They endured death threats and racist harassment after the Trump campaign seized on security camera footage to falsely claim it showed Freeman and Moss counting, quote, suitcases that they had pulled out from under a table. That was all not true. The Gateway Pundit was the first outlet to identify Freeman and Moss by name, and they continued to publish false posts about the mother and daughter months and even years after election officials had fully debunked the claims and cleared the women of any wrongdoing. The alleged the allegation that suitcases of ballots were pulled from under tables from the eyes of observers was almost immediately debunked, but Gateway Pundit and the Hoffs perpetuated the narrative anyway, publishing and promoting stories even after they were aware that the claims had been disproven, according to the suit. In a phone call with Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger on January 2 of 2021, Donald Trump had pressed Raffensperger to, quote, find votes for him that he needed to steal the election from Joe Biden, and he repeatedly mentioned Ruby Freeman by name, falsely calling her, quote, a vote scammer, a professional vote scammer, and a hustler. Last year, Freeman and Moss won a $148 million defamation verdict against Rudy Giuliani, Trump's one-time personal attorney. He had spread all kinds of false allegations about the women. He testified before the Georgia state legislature, lying about them. In addition to losing that suit, he has also now lost his law license in D.C. and in New York. He's been fired from his radio hosting job. He also filed for bankruptcy himself as the two women continue their efforts to collect on that judgment against the disgraced former New York City mayor and federal prosecutor. Giuliani also faces 13 criminal charges as part of the racketeering conspiracy case in Fulton County. Freeman and Moss also won an undisclosed settlement from the right-wing One America News Network 2 years ago. As part of the settlement, the right-wing network admitted that there was, in fact, no evidence that they committed fraud. Several people had accused of threatening Freeman and Moss, including an Illinois pastor and a former hip-hop publicist who visited Freeman's house, were also charged with racketeering in that criminal case and other felonies. Freeman was a temporary election worker back in 2020. Moss had worked for the Fulton County Elections Department since 2012, and she asked her mom, the elderly Freeman, to work on the election in the middle of the pandemic when election officials all over the country were desperate to find folks who were willing and able to work in those then very dangerous conditions. Her mom agreed to do the patriotic thing in helping out in that election, and all of this was the thanks that she received from jerks like Trump and Giuliani and the idiot Hoft brothers. She had to move out of her house for months. Anyway, I hope to hell they get a lot of money from those idiots. Quick break, and we're back with Desi Doyen in the Green News Report right after this. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is the Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad here at the Bradcast and bradblog.com. We fight for election integrity all year around, like no other media outlet in the nation. But of course, we need your help to help us remain on your public airwaves and completely independent. Please help us continue that fight over your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. And thanks. I think we got some good news in your GNR as well.
Yes, we do.
Don't we?
Wait for the end.
If you wait till the end of our latest Green News Report.
Definitely did not see this coming this bad. I didn't expect to be in an island.
Hurricane Milton is gone, but Florida is still grappling with its toxic aftermath.
FEMA has advised all federal responders in Rutherford County, North Carolina, to stand down and evacuate the county immediately.
Trump's lies about FEMA disrupt disaster aid to North Carolina. Plus, the UK ditches coal for good.
For very good. All of those stories and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Now that Marjorie Taylor Greene is doubling down on her claim that the Democrats can control the weather, someone has to ask her, if that were true, wouldn't it be a pretty good reason to vote for the Democrat?
This is your Green News Report.
If there are two parties, one that can't control the weather and one that can, I'm going to go with the one that can.
I'm gonna soak up the sun.
Okay, Desi Doyen, so where is this week's disastrous hurricane?
Well, good news. There are no hurricanes this week.
So far.
So far.
What do you got for us today?
Well, although record-breaking Hurricane Milton exited Florida days ago, the state is still plagued with power outages, fuel shortages, and an ongoing flood emergency from Milton's torrential rains. On Monday, at least 4 inland rivers remained at major flood stage, a few hitting all-time records, trapping people in their homes, even in areas that had not flooded before. Mm. The state's Department of Health issued an advisory urging residents to avoid the floodwaters. The storm directly cut across an area with more than 100 facilities storing industrial waste, and it caused the release of millions of gallons of untreated sewage.
Yikes.
Research shows that toxic chemicals and bacteria from sewage and debris in floodwaters can cause severe illnesses to hurricane survivors long after the storm passes. Milton also generated dozens of tornadoes, including at least one powerful EF3 tornado, the first ever EF3 recorded in conjunction with a hurricane since NOAA records began in 1965.
So these storms are getting worse in every seeming way.
Yep. Climate change also gave a significant boost to Milton's destructiveness. A new World Weather Attribution study found climate change made Milton's rainfall 30% more intense.
Mm-hmm.
Climate change also boosted Milton's winds, meaning the storm would have made landfall as a Category 2 hurricane, not a Category 3 without it. Preliminary estimates put Hurricane Milton's damage at roughly $50 billion across Florida. President Biden visited damaged areas on Sunday, announcing an additional $600 million to rebuild communities displaced by recent hurricanes and build more resilience into Florida's electric grid. MAGA House Republicans representing the state are demanding more disaster aid just weeks after voting against boosting FEMA's disaster relief fund.
They would have shut down FEMA entirely if it was up to them.
Yep. The fiscal year has barely begun, but FEMA warns it has already spent nearly half of the disaster relief that Congress has allocated for the next 12 months. The mounting toll of repeat disasters means that every year FEMA runs a deficit and must shift funding from long-term infrastructure projects to life-saving operations after disasters. In North Carolina, Hurricane Helene's impacts continue. The Food and Drug Administration announced a national shortage of three drugs after a manufacturer was damaged and shut down by the storm. Donald Trump and right-wing media's relentless campaign of lies and disinformation about the federal response to Hurricane Helene has also had very real consequences for both storm victims and federal disaster relief workers, despite being repeatedly debunked by Republican officials. An armed man was arrested Monday for threats against FEMA workers, and disaster recovery personnel in one North Carolina county were temporarily withdrawn after National Guard members reported armed militia groups said to be, quote, hunting FEMA. Meanwhile, Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump, after lying for weeks that the Biden administration was withholding disaster aid from some areas for political reasons, at a California rally over the weekend, himself pledged to withhold disaster aid from California for political reasons.
Of course.
And we'll force it down his throat. And we'll say, Gavin, if you don't do it, we're not giving you any of that fire money that we send you all the time for all the forest fires that you have.
But there is a tiny spot of good news. The UK is now 100% free of coal after more than 140 years. The birthplace of the Industrial Revolution has shut down its last coal-fired power plant for good.
And maybe Charles Dickens is celebrating. For much more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Can you hear the death knell toll for old King Cole?
I can hear it. Thank you very much, Desiree. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other we've ever done, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. That is still made possible by just those of you who click one of them donate buttons there or go straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com, and you'll find me on the social medias at The Brad Blog. We'll see you there until we see you here next time. Hopefully tomorrow. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
And there is no end to the pain we feel as you hear the death knell toll.